Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. Coming to you on a sunny day, direct from London town. And London in the spring is like any big city with a certain amount of greenery. Rather beautiful in the spring. So I hope that wherever you are, you know, the vistas are as nice as the ones that I'm looking at the moment. And it makes such a big difference, doesn't it? And you know what I think about the winter. Glad that we've seen the back of that for another year. And sorry if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, because yours is just beginning. I understand that. You know, that is the way of the world, as they say. Thank you very much if you've emailed recently. I am going to do a few shout-outs on this edition. So stand by for those. The website is theunexplained.tv, and you can easily follow the link there and send me a message. If you've recently sent a donation to the show, thank you very, very much for doing that. It's very, very kind of you. You know, if you've recently done that, and I know quite a few of you have, then, you know, it's just, you know, every penny gratefully received, and it is very, very important if you enjoy the show. Of course, a few people have got in touch and said, look, I'm not in a financial position to do that. And, you know, believe me, I know what it's like to live on a low income, and I totally understand that. So please just enjoy the show if that is your situation, and don't worry about it. But if you can make a donation, then please do, and thank you if you have. The guest on this edition, John Vivanco, and a different take on the subject of remote viewing, a subject we've dealt with here with people like Art Bell's Dr. Doom, Major Ed Dames, who we've had on the show quite a few times on radio and online. This time, John Vivanco, I think you will find very different in the way that he approaches all of this. So I think you're going to like this one with John Vivanco. All right, shout-outs now. Andrew Pontes, good to hear from you. Really enjoyed the Klaas Svahn interview. So did Anton, who I think is in Scandinavia. So, Anton, thank you for your feedback. Jason in Ireland liked Marcus Chown, and so did Craig and other people as well. Marcus Chown just has this ability, I think, to communicate science in a way that other people just don't. He puts it in a very practical way, and I find that very, very useful. It is a pity that we did that show just before the discovery of the big black hole, the imaging of that huge black hole into which 3 million planet Earths would fit, if they weren't, of course, all compressed to nothing by the time they got there. So we didn't have a chance to talk about that, but we did discuss the black hole on my radio show. Anthony, in Missouri, many thanks for the story that you sent me, Anthony, about seeing a strange man, quotes, out of time in the woods, and also a large white canine, you describe it. You say, I don't call it a dog because it wasn't one. There are no wolves in that area either. Coyotes are there, but it wasn't that. They don't chase humans because they're shy to us. I know well the wildlife, and that did not belong there, and nor did the man. So another weird sighting in a remote area. Thank you for that, Anthony. Steve in Hailsham, Sussex, UK. Good to hear from you. Eric, thank you for your suggestion. Richard, nice to know that you're off to, you'll probably be there now. Maybe you've even come back. You're off to Filey and Bempton and the Bempton Cliffs. An area that we've discussed here, of course, with Truth Proof, you know, with the Truth Proof books being centred, a lot of them in that kind of area. So I'd be interested to know if you saw or experienced anything odd there, Richard. Robert in Wisconsin, thank you. Scott in Aurora, Colorado, says some nice things. Thank you very much. We have done the Mandela effect, Scott, but we'll do it again. We've mentioned it online, and we've had guests about it on the radio. Jacob in Portsmouth, Hampshire, UK, says, thank you for many hours of entertainment and education. I've been listening since you first came on iTunes, and I look forward to the shows. Thank you. Perfect compliment when I'm fishing in the twilight hours. Quick suggestion for the donations page. Have you considered including merchandise, T-shirts, that kind of thing? I think receiving a small gift in exchange would encourage more visitors. Yeah, it takes some organizing and a certain amount of budget. I'm not in the position to do it yet. But, you know, when we get bigger, that would certainly be part of the plan, I would say. And thank you for that, Jacob, in Portsmouth. I know Portsmouth well, because among the many radio stations that I worked on was Ocean Sound. Well, it was Ocean Sound first, and then Ocean FM back in the day, and a station called Power FM. Used to be a kind of fast-paced, American-style music station, 103.2, Power FM. And I was the guy who did the news. And we were the first people on that station to do in the UK a very short form of news. So cutting everything down to 80 seconds I had to tell it all, with a music bed running underneath. And this was the very end of the 80s. Nobody else had done that. And there we were doing it on Power FM, a station which very sadly doesn't exist anymore, like a lot of others in the UK. They've been consolidated. But as you know, in America, that is the way of the industry, which is one of the good reasons for doing podcasts, because the podcaster's art is a growing one. Now, to the guest on this edition, John Vivanco, author, speaker, instructor of the remote viewing method, Transdimensional Systems, and investigator. John has been remote viewing and teaching students for more than 20 years. He was part of the first civilian remote viewing organizations after the government declassified the program, 25 years, I think it is, or so ago. His organization was hired to investigate the unknown, including work with the FBI after 9/11. Interesting man. So let's get to the United States now without any more waiting and get to John Vivanco on The Unexplained. John, thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about where you are then.
Where I am currently living?
Yeah.
That is Washington State, Pacific Northwest, full of volcanoes and trees and, well, Bigfoot.
Yeah. Now, does it give you a boost in your remote viewing work to be in a location that is replete with high strangeness and things like Bigfoot that you can actually get to remote view?
Actually, that's huge. We find magnetic anomalies around volcanoes. And you find that a lot in the Pacific Northwest. And I teach classes at this location that is actually a UFO hotspot. And I've been doing this on a regular basis. And what I'm finding is that the ability of the remote viewers, people that haven't done this before, now, you know, anyone can do this and you can learn this anywhere. But in these locations where there are magnetic anomalies and a high amount of Earth energies, it really amps it up. This is one of the reasons why I'm up here, is because of the energy of these locations. It makes for much better remote viewing sessions, much clearer, more internal adventures, in a sense.
All right. Well, we need to be getting into all of this, because all of that taps into and speaks to the things that we will be discussing in this conversation. Talk to me about you, then. Are you a scientist? What's your background?
Well, So, I'm sure your listeners know the story of remote viewing, where it came from, out of, you know, U.S. intelligence and Stanford Research Institute in the 1970s developing this at their request, and then declassified in 1995. Now, I'm a civilian. My background is actually in fine art. And I was entranced by the term psychic spy when I first heard of this declassification. I think there was a news report, a U.S. news report on it, and it took me. You know, up to that point, I hadn't considered myself psychic in any way, and I had to learn about it. So I learned basically on my own how to do it, because it is a methodology. It's very structured. It's like a technology. And I learned how to do this, you know, picking out little pieces that I heard from other people who had gotten trained, because I didn't have the money to get trained back then. It was expensive. You know, you're looking at $5,000 for a weekend course. Mm-hmm. So after I learned it and I saw, wow, there's something going on here, I got formal training. Now, because of my fine art background, see, I'm taught, anyone's taught with, when they go into fine art in a representational way, to basically describe how light falls on a surface. So that creates a very physical remote viewer, because, you know, we don't all look at our world in these very physical ways. We have concepts and metaphors that we live through with everything around us. But this translated into remote viewing for me as a physical remote viewer, and I came to find out that that is a valued asset. So I got pulled into a think tank very, very soon after I was formally trained.
Whose think tank was that?
This think tank was called Transdimensional Systems. It was a civilian think tank, not connected to the military, not connected to the government. These were people who were interested in just remote viewing after it became declassified. And so they pulled me into it, and you know, I received a salary. There was a an investor. We had companies, corporations that we worked for, as well as U.S. intelligence services, different aspects of intelligence. What happened was around 2001, when the Twin Towers, the terrorist attack in New York City, when they went down, the FBI asked us to do counterterror. And
hold on, you were group of civilians who were doing this in a fairly serious way, and you got an approach from the security agency?
Yeah, we had handlers in various agencies before that, but when we got in working with the FBI in counterterror after 9/11, it leaked to the press. And at that point in time, you know, we asked the handler if we could do some of these interviews. The handler said, fine, go ahead, but we won't confirm or deny anything. So we started working with them. Actually, the first thing that we worked on with them was whether the Twin Towers, see, underneath the Twin Towers is this huge cavern and a large concrete wall in order to keep the river out of the lower Manhattan, right?
And I think the way that it was laid out is that there's the subway underneath there, isn't there?
There's all sorts of things going on underneath there. Yes, the subway runs underneath there. But, you know, this huge wall is there to keep the river out, the Hudson out of lower Manhattan. And they did not know whether that wall was breached or not, cracked, ready to fail. So the first thing they had us do was remote view if that wall had any compromises in it. They could not get down.
So they actually came to you, and presumably, right, you know, the government was also working with engineers and others. But such was the situation, and we all know that it was traumatized and chaotic after 9/11. You know, I went through that covering it as a journalist, so I know, and then subsequently went to New York to see it all for myself. But we know that in the aftermath of that, I presume, and this includes the government, people were looking for answers wherever they could find them.
That's true, you know, absolutely. In fact, I've even spoke to some people who were screenwriters, Hollywood screenwriters, who were approached by the FBI to come up with every single scenario they can come up with on a future terrorist attack. So yeah, they were scared, you know, they were trying to figure out how do we stop this next one, right? And we were one of those avenues. But, you know, it was the first test in a sense, because they couldn't get engineers down there, and they wanted to make sure that, you know, we could view and come up with information that later on could match up with the engineers found. And it did. We found that the wall was not breached. It was not compromised. It was steady, strong, and that the lower Hudson wouldn't be flooding into there anytime soon. So at least in geologic time. So, that was fine. So what they did from there is they asked us to hunt for bin Laden. We declined that offer because, you know, ethically, we didn't want to fall on the side of a drone strike somewhere where civilians get hit, whether we supplied a little bit of information or not. We just didn't want to do that. So,
and yet you were probably put, I would think, but I don't want to put words into your mouth, in an invidious position because you're being asked to do your patriotic duty.
Right. And that's why we were doing it, you know, care for the country.
But
right?
You didn't want to try and locate, the prime mover in this.
Right.
The man who was suspected of being the prime mover at the time.
Suspected. Right. Right. We did not want to do that. We did not, because of potential civilian casualties. And, you know, we figured that they had a gazillion assets on that, as well as other remote viewers.
When they make communication with you, how do they do that? Do they do it in a low-key way? Do they say, look, you know, your team has had some success with doing this. We're currently tasked with doing this. We wonder if you might want to have some input.
Basically, yeah, through email or phone, and It depended on what it was. So with regard to any counterterror work, it was pretty much straightforward. They would give us this overall question that they wanted to understand. For instance, we shifted into future terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. You know, we thought that would be helpful, as well as, you know, not get us into any, you know, karmic trouble in a sense, where other people get killed because of actions or information that we give, right? So we shifted into that. And so they would ask us, Okay, next month, within a month, can you determine any future terrorist attacks that occur on U.S. soil? So we started working on those types of questions. Now, we were free to take that general umbrella question and task our team of remote viewers in any way that we wanted in order to get the information that they needed. So we had a lot of leeway within that. Now, on the other side of that, you know, we would give them this information, and we didn't sit down with tea time with the FBI because they don't tell you anything. So they just take the information and they roll with it. We find out later through news reports that related to, for instance, we had an attack occurring on stadium in different capacities from, excuse me, from biologicals dumped over a stadium event to totally contained stadiums and biologicals going through the vents.
Hold on. Those are things that your remote viewing team had seen.
Yeah, we had perceived those on projects.
So are you saying that because we haven't had those, that your information helped to stop them?
Well, there's two things there, right? So for one thing, since there's no tea time with the FBI, you know, we don't know 100% for sure. But the other side of that are news reports that come out later. And there were specific news reports on information that they gained from, I can't remember his name, but they held him at Guantanamo, one of the leaders of Al-Qaeda back then. And he told them eventually about a planned attack on stadiums in the manner that we described. So we would be looking at these things pretty much either week after week, every 2 weeks, or every month, and they would constantly change. So, you know, you have two things there. Either the future is not set, or these guys are working off of our information in order to stop these things, right?
Okay. Now, that prompts another question, though. You know, if, say, this month you are remote viewing some possible outcome of a nefarious, bad terror attack on the U.S. somewhere, that's been planned, as all of these things are clandestinely planned and executed, then when you come to look at things in another month, then obviously the dynamic will have changed because possibly you've stopped all or part of that. So as you say, the landscape is constantly changing.
It's constantly changing. And this, you know, before I engaged in that specific type of work, you know, I thought that, well, if we remote viewed that in the future as a future event, well, then it's bound to happen, right? For sure. And it would shift, it would change, it would morph, you know, it would shift from a biological or chemical in a stadium to explosions after a couple of weeks.
How long after 9/11? Were you checking out those possibilities? Are you still checking them out?
We did that for 2 years after 9/11 happened. And occasionally we do work still in that realm.
Now, listen, I don't expect people who come on this show to swear an affidavit. It doesn't work like that. It's an interchange of views. But the only proof that you did this I have is you're telling me. How can I know that? How can I know that what you're telling me is so?
You know, that's the thing. This is when you get into the world of intelligence and civilian, for one thing, we weren't under non-disclosure on this. And there is nobody on the side of law enforcement that could or would verify this for you. So ultimately, yes, the only thing that you have is my word and the word of other remote viewers. Occasionally you hear a story where another remote viewer will pop up who have been asked by the FBI back then to view counterterror issues as well.
And I've got a feeling, to be perfectly honest with you, John, if you were going and, you know, if you were, I mean, I don't know. Okay, so before my listener accuses me of anything, but if you were going around and saying these things, especially at a sensitive time like the couple of years after 9/11, where feelings and sensibilities were incredibly raw, if you were going around saying those things and you were not under a non-disclosure because there wasn't one to exist, somebody would phone you up and say, this is whoever it might be calling from whichever agency it might be, Alphabet Agency. We suggest you stop.
Yeah,
I presume that would happen, but you know that's a big presumption. But that seems to be the way things happen. Now, look, we've leapt ahead in leaps and bounds, and actually, just for people who are new to all of this, people I interview about remote viewing, like Major Ed Dames, who I've known for 20 years, They talk about protocols. We use protocols in remote viewing, but we've never really had a conversation on this show of precisely what the protocols are for being able to remote view. And I think we need to do two things, if you wouldn't mind. Number one, just quickly give me a definition of what you think remote viewing is. And number two, these protocols, what are they and how do they work?
Right. You know, remote viewing is really a way to gain, you know, in the physics term, non-local information on anything. And it basically means that it's something that is outside of the realm of your five senses. You are perceiving something that's not right in front of you. And it's an inherent thing that we all have. We can all do this. I've taught, it's got to be thousands of people by now, and anyone can do this. There hasn't been one failure in teaching. Now, whether someone keeps going with this is another thing. So remote viewing is based off of psi or psychic functioning, clairvoyance. In the there are two aspects to remote viewing. There is the protocol, and then there's the methodology. So the protocol is basically the way that we task a remote viewer. Now you can't go to a psychic or a remote viewer and ask them what you want to know. Straight up without letting them know what you want to know. So remote viewing, the protocol is a way to task them without actually telling them what you want to know so they can't make things up, right? And it works off of the way they originally started with was they use a coordinate system. So the coordinates on Earth, you can give a remote viewer the coordinates of a location that they know nothing about. There are millions, you can't memorize them. And then they just begin to describe what's there. And that was some of the early testing that they did, and they used that operationally as well. So that shifted, right? So when you think about coordinates as this kind of conceptual grid, number relating to a location, all they did was shift that to a random 8-digit number connected to something written down that you wanted the viewer to view. That way you can be more precise. So I could write down a historical event associated with an 8-digit number, or I can write down, you know, remote view the Eiffel Tower right now, current time, or I could have you remote view it in the past or something in the future or something on the other side of the universe.
But when the FBI came to you, they specifically said, we would like you to find Osama bin Laden.
Right. So we operate with a team. And this is the other aspect of remote viewing. For good projects, good data, you need to have the remote viewers blind to what they are going to view. So they have no idea. And they're highly trained. They're constantly in training, and there are operational target slipped in between. So they never know what they're going to be viewing at all. And they're just given a random 8-digit number that is associated with something. And from there, they work through what we call a remote viewing methodology. It's a very structured framework in order to write down information in. So remote viewing itself is not a psychic functioning, right? It is only a format in which to get in which to put information in and pull out more information. So those two aspects are sometimes mashed into one, calling it the remote viewing protocol, but they're actually quite separate. And because we work with a team, so those viewers are all blind. You got five remote viewers, and they all are tasked on the same question. You take their sessions, you know, they could be up to 20 pages each, and the analyst corroborates the data between the sessions in order to create the report. And what this does is it creates a very extremely high accuracy rate rather than just using a single remote viewer on a single question, right? Because you work off the corroborative points in the session to build the picture. And that is how we can be so accurate. And that's typically how it works, you know, even within the military.
But that puts a lot of pressure on the person who is sifting and collating the data, doesn't it? If you say that all of the remote viewers who work on a team are unconnected and they're all providing their input, somebody has to make an interpretation, and that's a human thing, of that data.
Absolutely. And that could be a huge failure point. So, you know, you want your remote viewers to be trained very, very well, long-term remote viewers who are very in tune with the process of it. And also you need to understand their mind, how they perceive the world, because as humans, you know, we don't perceive the world in this straight one-to-one ratio physical way, right? We perceive it as concepts, ideas, how we move through our days, the metaphors and ideas about our own life. And when you begin to understand the mind of your individual remote viewers on the team is when you can understand how to interpret their data if they go that path.
Right. Okay. So when these people are remote viewing and they're trying to get impressions of the target, presumably what they have to write them on a sketch pad, do they?
Yeah. You know, we use paper, a lot of pens. And it runs from what we call ideograms, ideogrammatic language. Ideograms are the bridge between the subconscious or supraconscious mind and the language mind. It creates a symbol. So an ideogram is basically a scribble. And there are certain scribbles that represent certain things. It comes from the all-knowing body, in a sense. And then the remote viewer uses that, works off of that to get basic sensory information, five senses. So the information comes in all these different ways. Remote viewing, the term, it's not really remote viewing. So for one thing, we hear things, smell things, we feel textures, we have general knowingness, we have gestalt ideas. We feel sensations in our body that translate into something. And we write all of this stuff down in this very strict format. There are visuals, the viewing part, but that's not the majority of it. So the viewing part of remote viewing, the term is not exactly correct. And then here's the other side of it. When we remote view, we kind of close our eyes and go inside of ourselves. So there's nothing actually remote about it in the process, because it is a journey inside the self when you do this. So the term itself, it's erroneous to a certain degree. I mean, you know, in space-time here, three-dimensional space-time, it does make some sense, but in the process, it makes no sense at all. In fact, you know, I lived in a Zen center for many years.
In a Zen center?
Zen, so all we did was meditate. That's all I did. It's Zen Buddhism. In fact, it was a Japanese style, Rinzai Zen. And for me, what it came down to was that everything, we are one. Everything is us. And all of that is within us. And we wouldn't be able to remote view it if it weren't us. You know, because what we do is go inside our body. And, you know, they actually could have called these early experiments a demonstration in oneness as opposed to remote viewing, because it is that. It is that. It's a
demonstration. I've never heard it explained that way before, and it makes an awful lot of sense. If, as a lot of people, especially of a religious perspective, Eastern religious perspective, say that we are all one and all things are one. So if things that you are wanting to see and experience and understand a part of the one, then all you need to do, I mean, it makes it sound simple, is put yourself into a state where it's possible for you to access that. Now, I wonder if there is, I often have an experience where I'm drifting off to sleep. And sometimes if I've been working a run of shifts and I'm particularly tired, I'll be lying there in that kind of half asleep and half awake state, waiting to go into full unconsciousness. And in that phase, for as long as I can remember, since I was a teenager, I will frequently see little tableaus play out, you know, moving images, people, things, streets, you know, all sorts of scenes that will play out as if it's a little movie in my forehead area with my eyes closed, but I will see it. Is that a form of remote viewing?
Isn't that fantastic? I love that. Absolutely. That's the visual aspect of remote viewing. So we'll use what we call binaural beats, theta, in the theta range. So we have brain waves, right? Alpha, beta, theta is before sleep. When you drop down into delta, right? And in that realm, that's where those hypnagogic and hypnopompic visions show up. So in remote viewing, we do try to access that, drop down into that zone with theta binaural beats. And, we will get the same kind of crisp visuals rolling out. Now, you can actually direct yourself when you're falling asleep of things that you want to see and know about. Einstein, Max Planck, Thomas Edison, in fact, he would sit there on a chair if he had a problem that he needed to solve with a handful of marbles or BBs. Underneath that would be a pie tin on the floor. He would have this question in his mind, something he needed to solve, and he would drift off into that zone that you drift off when you're going to sleep with the intent of getting an answer. He would see that answer. Now, when you go into Delta, you lose muscle control. So his hand would collapse, drop the marbles in the pie tin and wake him up. So he would remember the answer to his question. And anybody can use this. And that's really similar to remote viewing. In fact, that's more like what we call extended remote viewing, which is an aspect or a methodology within remote viewing where you kind of lie down and you have somebody who's writing everything down for you instead of what we do now is just write it down ourselves on paper.
So you do what I do when I'm in those yep. semi-sleeping states, add some discipline, and essentially you've got remote viewing.
Essentially you do. Yeah, it's fantastic. You'd probably be a great remote viewer if you're hitting that and paying attention to it.
Well, you know, I've often wondered about these things that unfold like little movies. And they will be things that of which I have not, I have no experience. They're not things that I've necessarily seen or they're not places that I've been to. And yet these little movies will unfold and, you know, the next thing I will be asleep. But I'm clearly aware of them. Does this process, when you start to discipline yourself to do it, and I'm asking you this for a reason, John, does it mess with your head? There was a movie, which I'm sure you've seen, called Suspect Zero, with Ben Kingsley as the remote viewer.
Right.
Not a very widely seen movie, I think a fantastic piece of acting. And it features a cameo role by Major Ed Dames, who's seen for a split second as an instructor in that movie. But the remote viewer, who's worked for the agencies, is somehow connected with a terrible serial killer. But it messes with his head to the extent that he just wants it to turn off. Turn it off. Please shut this thing off. I want it to go away. Is it like that? Can it be like that?
Yeah, it can be. When I first started doing this and got pulled into a think tank, I was remote viewing. My job was to remote view 5 days a week, anywhere from 2 to 3 sessions per day, and each session can last up to 2 hours. And so I was always in that state. And your brain structure changes, the new synapses form within the brain to accommodate this functioning. And it can have a destabilizing effect, and it can be on all the time. So, you know, the best way a person can deal with that is to meditate, is to go inside themselves. Then that's the way to deal with any type of destabilization that occurs in this process. But yeah, you know, it can. It definitely can. But I think it's something that humans need to be aware of and grow into as being a natural ability that we have. It's an evolutionary step in my mind, and not only evolutionary in this idea that yes, we can do it, but in the idea of going inside of ourselves to be able to deal with this new way of being. So, yeah.
Hmm. There are limits, presumably, on what you can see, what you can explore. I'm thinking particularly about a story that appeared in our newspapers here quite recently. And stories like this appear from time to time, and I'm sure they do in America. I know they do in America. Somebody was convinced that behind a rock on Mars, they saw a penguin. And, you know, there was this photograph published, and it might have been, I think it was the effects of pareidolia, where your mind just makes sense of something that actually is quite random. But you know, if you think penguin, then you see penguin. Could I task you to check out what really is on the surface of Mars and whether there is some kind of clandestine life there?
Yeah, you know, we've looked a lot on Mars, and we approach it in a very, straightforward way where, you know, we will take these photographs, satellite type photographs or stuff from the rover, and just have the remote viewers describe the form or landform or whatever in the photographs. And sometimes we'll get straight up, it's a geologic thing that happened through time there, or, you know, wind, environmental conditions, they'll be describing that. Or sometimes they will describe structures. Now, as far as life goes, we have not run into life forms yet, and I wouldn't leave that out of the equation.
Have you run into the remnants of life forms that once existed?
Oh, absolutely have. We were working a project where we were mapping out especially the Cydonia region of Mars, where you find what they call the face on Mars and some other structures. And we'd found that, yes, those are they're huge artificial structures. That area used to be on the edge of a sea, very lush. These structures were like, they would be akin to ancient Maya type structures here on the, on our planet. The people, the beings that created them were very human-like, but much smaller, reddish skin, very much like our, ancient Indians in Latin America, Mexico. And these structures were literally all over the place. And they, you know, some of these structures were built, some of these structures we found that they would commit suicide to become part of the structure. So they had these steps and ramps that went up very high, and they just take a leap down into this pit within the structure, because it was, the structure was a representative of their culture, representation of their culture and everything that was great about it. And one of the highest honors was that they could become part of it by suiciding themselves within the structure. So, you know, similar to ancient ideas here. And it makes you wonder, you know, how those beings are related to our ancient cultures here.
And are they indeed us? And did have you been able to check whether the theory goes, doesn't it, that there was some kind of great apocalyptic event on Mars that meant those who were on Mars, well, many perished, but some of them had to come here. And that's why
Absolutely.
We're here.
Yep, we've run into that as well. Major cataclysm on Mars that... You know, the Valles, what is this major gash in Mars? Valles Marineris, I don't think I'm pronouncing it right. It's a huge canyon. We found that that canyon was created during the destruction of Mars, and the atmosphere basically blew away. And in that time period, some of these beings were taken off, transported off. So it's likely that
under their own steam, under their own power, or did some other agency or race or alien force transport them?
Some other alien force, something else took them. Now we have the moon of Mars too, Phobos, which is, when we looked at that, an artificial structure that was monitoring what was happening on the planet. Which is fascinating as well.
So who say that Phobos is some kind of craft, built thing are right, you say?
Right. Yeah. From our remote viewing data. Now, the way we approach it, always blind projects. Viewers just begin to describe things. And so we're not, you know, making things up from the realm of our, you know, imagination. You know, when you get remote viewing data with blind viewers and you've got five viewers and you're cross-corroborating the data and you're coming up with the same artificial structure throughout the whole thing, it gets pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, because, you know, there is a big truth in inverted commas, in quotation marks, that at some point, presumably, the rest of us are going to be let in on.
Yeah, presumably. Right. Yeah.
Okay, well... That's astonishing. Have you had any input from the likes of NASA? Do they want to know what you're doing?
Well, not so. See, these guys, the government agencies, they kind of don't want to have a lot to do with the civilian side of remote viewers. And if they do, it's through the back door. So we never had direct dealings with NASA. We have had... experiences where we have our own alien encounters as remote viewers, because when you remote view something and you're remote viewing something that has more of a developed consciousness, it can be aware that you're viewing it. And so because of that, remote viewers will have contact experiences.
Are you saying that you've actually been in contact through remote viewing with sentient creatures who are aware that you are looking at them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
And how does that feel?
Well, it's bizarre. We have, so they'll approach in a couple of different ways. You could have a physical visitation or telepathic, very high intensity, visceral telepathic communication. There was this one instance where we were asked to work, help. It was Ruben Ariarte, who he's the Northern California MUFON director. He was working on a television show. This was around 2000, the year 2000, called Beyond Boundaries. And what they would do on this show, they would travel the world to look for areas of high strangeness, UFOs. It was a, you know, one of those reality shows. And they wanted us to remote view where they could find a chupacabra in Puerto Rico, because that was the destination of their next show. Outside of that, they also wanted us to remote view these lights. People were seeing these lights that were coming from the sky down into the jungle. And the locals around the Arecibo radio telescope were seeing this. And the Arecibo was that huge telescope featured in the movie Contact with Jodie Foster. Mm. Yeah. And we viewed these lights. So I was the first viewer in. I was blind. And I immediately got, well, I'll tell you one interesting thing. NASA had told the locals around the area that they said, well, those lights, we're just bringing our satellites down for service, so you don't need to worry about it.
Okay.
Right, so that was their explanation for it. So when I viewed it, I was...
That assumes that... What are you assuming here, that they knew what they really were?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Otherwise, I don't know why they'd say that.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted you.
No problem. So being the first viewer in, I immediately was getting alien life forms, and they were moving through the sky, sort of burning in the atmosphere as they came down and swirling, and they were almost in these little pods that they would come out of. They were very organic. And when I was viewing that, they kind of turned their heads towards me as this was happening in the session. And I even wrote down, they're aware of me, and they're going to come. They're coming. So, you know, I do this session. I'm a little freaked out by it, but, you know, that's standard in some of these sessions. And it was about, oh, I don't know, not that long after, maybe a month or so, I'm at home, and it's the evening. I'm really tired, inordinately tired. This didn't make any sense to me. So I go to sleep early, and all of a sudden I'm in, immediately upon falling asleep, in this very bizarre dream where I'm stuck in space and I'm needing help to get out. And during this dream, these beings come forward. And while this is happening, okay, I'm laying in bed, I'm getting poked on my shoulder. This is outside of the dream, physically laying in bed. I'm getting poked on the shoulder. So I grabbed the hand. I thought it was my wife. I thought I was talking in my sleep. And this hand pulled away from me as this was going on. And it was this weird, slick, bumpy feeling. And so I sat up, opened my eyes, sat up in bed. And I don't know, about 5-10 feet in front of me is this thing standing there, full thing. Physical thing. Right. So it had this head that was shaped like a football on its side. I'd say it was about... I don't know, a foot and a half long, the head, and it had these two eyes on the far ends of the football, right? This little tiny mouth in the middle, kind of a translucent, what I'd call a nose.
That sounds and like then, E.T. from the movie.
It, you know, similar, but so think of the head as being longer, like a big football, like an American football, not a soccer ball.
Right.
And underneath this football head were all these bumps, and then there was this sort of these spindly limbs. Now, it didn't have, you know, any sort of bipedal thing that we think of. It had just almost like, it was like octopus limbs. This sounds insane, absolutely insane, but that's what was right in front of me. So,
had you had any beer that night?
No, nothing.
just thought I should ask.
You know?
I mean, this is extraordinary. So because you've been looking, something came looking for you.
Right. Now, this was outside of any kind of understanding that I had of alien life forms, because, you know, we think in terms of aliens as this gray style with the big, huge almond shaped eyes. You know, that's the popular culture alien, you know, and this was not that. It was something completely different. So I'm there, I'm completely freaking out. I've got gazillions of tons of adrenaline flowing through me, and I'm trying to back up away from this thing. And it literally says into my head, stop what you're doing. It's like you're throwing bricks at me. I guess it was my emotions that were just shooting out at it, and it was hurting it. And it said, basically it said, now we called this old project the Signal, right? So we had names for projects, and it said, we are from the Signal, and we're here to help you, and we want you to help us. So that was really bizarre. So then at that point, it kind of backed up, and it exploded into lights, and it was gone. Now I couldn't sleep. I'm like, I'm hyperventilating, not knowing what's going on. I didn't tell anybody else on my team about this, but it shows up to other team members later on. Same messaging. Now, at that point, I'd gotten used to them, to the idea of it. They would show up like that, physical, or they would show up as these flying blue orbs, and they showed up to the team, the rest of the team, that way as well. And they wanted us to actually work on a project for them. And this is where it gets even weirder. If you thought that was weird, this is, so they didn't come here for humans. They didn't want anything to do with humans. So it makes you wonder, you know, we're so egotistical. Well, aliens have got to be here for us. But no, they didn't.
So what are they looking for? Were they looking for natural resources, energy? What?
These guys, they wanted us to work on a project. Now, they told me that there are these fireflies that are in danger. And I thought, there's no way fireflies are in danger, because these things are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And they showed me these fireflies that blink on and off, all synchronous. So they all do it at the same exact time. It's not random. So I started looking it up. And there were two locations where these fireflies, the specific kind called Pteroptix tenor, placed in the Amazon and a place in Malaysia. Now, the one in Malaysia, their habitat was getting destroyed, and they were very endangered. And those were the ones that they wanted us to save. So we found out that they are genetically related to, they're like cousins to these fireflies, and their habitat is getting destroyed, and they needed their habitat to not get destroyed and have them disappear, because, you know, out in the realm of beyond our space time, there's a whole different thing happening. And it is like, if this disappears, there's an aspect of them that will disappear.
Right. So it's not just a kind of altruistic thing. There's an actual survival aspect to it.
Right. So we set about on a project on how to, you know, save these fireflies. You know, we were remote viewing this blind project, and, you know, it was like, do a documentary, get some celebrities in there, Malaysian celebrities, this and that. But, you know, we didn't have the pull to do that. We talked to some producers, but not interested. You know, but they were interested in how this came to us. But, you know, I'm not going to go on TV and talk about it like that, because it just turns into this crazy time. So, you know, we couldn't do anything. We just couldn't do anything about it. Now, within remote viewing, we do have these healing protocols that we sometimes work. And it's called remote healing. So we developed a protocol and methodology in order to heal environments and environmental conditions. You know, whether that works or not, it's cause versus causation, right? It's correlation versus causation, right? So what happened was, we started working it that way because we could not get a documentary going. And eventually the dam that was built is slowly being decommissioned. The population started to gain a lot of interest in how to save that habitat, and they started cleaning it up. So, you know, whether remote healing works from the standpoint of directly pushing energy into it to miraculously heal it, or it pulls on other resources, we don't know. But something did happen, and I'm grateful for that, because it is what they wanted to have happen. And whether we had any part of that, I honestly couldn't tell you. But
did they tell you anything about themselves, where they're from, how they get here, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so they were you know, they in part did. So when you communicate with beings that don't use language the way you use it, or meanings the way you use it, it gets a little tricky. So, you know, on top of trying to figure out their communications, we also remote view it as a team, right? And there is this cluster of dark matter, M31 or something. We identified the specific area that they came from, and I'd have to go back through my resources to figure that out. I think it's in my book, actually, the location where I laid that out. But it was this area of dark matter that they came from, and that area is that they were in was under collapse, and I believe it was probably related to what was happening here on Earth with this other species of fireflies. And that's what kind of drew them here. And the reason we called this project the single signal. Now, one thing we knew was that Arecibo was picking up intermittently their movement transitions because, you know, when you go into these high strangeness realms with these beings in it, they don't behave or act the way we act or move the way we move. There are, you know, it's not this straight physical thing. And putting our understanding of our physical understanding on another species, it doesn't usually work. So these guys were moving through a signal that they created that was actually able to be picked up by Arecibo. So we knew that they had captured some signal that they were moving through. Really bizarre. So it borders this three-dimensional into fourth-dimensional zone and world and kind of blows your perspective open on how other beings utilize energy and move with it.
There are many people who talk about various species and races of aliens, some of whom are, you know, benevolent towards us. They have our best intentions, you know, to heart. Others who are malevolent. Did you get any sense of that?
There was nothing malevolent about them at all. And I
okay, but I'm just wondering if you've come into contact with other races, species.
Yeah, you know, there's the since I was a kid, I had had experiences where very mentally and physically aggressive beings would come to my window that looked like our, you know, the typical gray type beings with the almond shaped eyes. And I would get they would pull me out of the window. And then later on, I'd wake up out in the field behind my house, a very rural area with no clothes on, and I'd have to make my way back into the house. And this happened on a regular basis, and I shut it away. Very bizarre. And I didn't understand it. I didn't know what was happening. And so later on, I found out this was, you know, when I saw that book, Communion, Whitley Strieber, and perceiving, you know, he's got that gray alien face on the cover. I couldn't look at it. Freaked me out because it brought back these memories.
And then he tells very, very three-dimensional and very chilling accounts of what occurred to him, as you will know.
Right, exactly. Yep. And it was, you know, a lot of that stuff that Whitley Strieber talks about.
I asked you, John, to, I don't know whether you can do this, historically, to go back to the days, say, of Betty and Barney Hill, or to Calvin Parker in the 70s, you know, who say that they were abducted by something, taken away for a while, would you be able to check details of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, a long time ago, we did view Betty and Barney Hill incident. And the way we view these things is to find out the reality of it, whether it truly happened or not, whether they are making up a story or there's something physical that happened.
And what did you find?
See, this is the issue with this, is that when we view this stuff, we attract the attention of those beings that abducted them. And that's exactly what happened back then as well. So they really were taken. They really were abducted. I don't remember all the details of it because it was so long ago, a project that we did. But yes, they were. It actually did happen. They were telling the truth about it. And they were those mentally aggressive, physically aggressive beings that have been doing it to a lot of people. So yeah, we do. We check into some of these things. Now, there are some that are completely fabricated, at least from a remote viewing perspective. So not everything is something.
Mm. What about the, you know, more global concerns, quite literally? the future of this planet. You know, there are people who say that we're going to destroy it because the climate is collapsing around us. There are going to be so many people that we won't have enough food, so a lot of people will die. Sea level rise, asteroid impact, all that sort of stuff. Do you have any idea, or indeed war might wipe us out? Do you have any sense of how this particular book that we're all writing together as a human race might end? What the final chapter may be?
Right. I know. Well, this is the funny thing. Time is always shifting and always changing, and there are impacts on our timeline that happen on a regular basis, especially when people know what the future could possibly be, when there's a lot of consciousness. It's like the double slit experiment, where you can shoot photons through these strips, and if there's an observer, it will change the nature of the outcome of the experiment. So think of the remote viewers, and think of consciousness itself on future events can shift future events.
So in other words, with something so big and amorphous as a question of how will what's the ultimate future of life on this planet, it's not possible to do that because the outcome is always changing?
It's always changing. I guarantee you that. I guarantee you. Now, as the closer you get to some type of event, the more accurate your data will be, right? I mean, it was, when Donald Trump was running for president. This was 9 months, 10 months before the elections here in the United States. We did projects on who would be president, whether Hillary Clinton would or Donald Trump would, and we kept getting Donald Trump, right? So the closer
when the media and the polls were saying Hillary Clinton.
When the media and polls were saying Hillary Clinton, exactly. And I had gone on some radio programs back then. We're talking about, they bring that up, the elections. I'd bring up Trump and I'd get laughed off the show because nobody believed that. But the closer you get to, I'd say, you're talking about a year frame, year time frame. The closer you get, 3 months, it's going to be even more accurate. But there are still things that can knock it off, right? One of the things when we were working with the FBI on counterterror after 9/11 is that one of the things the handler told us was that, yes, you can do it. We don't mind that. And we want you to tell them everything that you're getting in your remote viewing data. And I know that the reason for that is because he knew that consciousness can shift events when there's enough consciousness there pointed at it. So it's an interesting area that doesn't have a lot of study, right? This, how can you study it? It's a difficult area to pin down.
And I presume if you're looking back at something in history, say you were looking at the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, for example, or the death of Marilyn Monroe, to name two connected examples, apparently, presumably you can't make any change in things that have happened.
Presumably, but that may just be a mindset. It could be that, because this is just mind. All this is mind. That's it. Mm. And we are in a collective belief system on it. Think about when in the 30s, the 50s? I can't remember exactly. When nobody thought you could break, I think it was the 3-minute mile. Or 4-minute mile.
Yeah, 4-minute mile was a guy called Roger Bannister in this country.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. There you go. Roger Bannister. And nobody thought you could do it. And really, the way he broke it was because of his mental attitude. He shifted it. Then what happened after that? Well, people started breaking that. And I think that is an evolution of the collective will break things, right?
Well, so, on a lot of levels, that makes sense to me. Look, on a practical level, I am a broadcaster and journalist. I didn't choose to work in banking or finance or go into politics. I'd have had some money if I did. I'm a broadcaster. Many of us are broke fairly permanently. I would love to win the lottery. Could I use remote viewing to view next Thursday's lottery numbers here in the UK?
Absolutely. In fact, I was just teaching a class where one of the students, he was doing a remote viewing session and he kept getting repeating numbers in his head. He's like, why am I getting repeating numbers? And so he took these and played the lottery and won $20 or something. So yeah, you can. And there are methods that we have using the fingers, a numbers method, in order to work the lottery. Now, I don't typically play it. I'm not, yeah, I don't know. The lottery, it just, when it comes to gambling and remote viewing, I'm not so much into it, but
I'm actually wondering whether any of that might be illegal. I mean, if it's something that you can't actually physically prove, I can't see how it could be. But it just kind of reminds me of that movie Rain Man, you know, where right. the character was counting cards.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But yes, it can be done. There are viewers who do it on a regular basis. Some viewers are very focused on that and do win on a regular basis. Now, any big winnings, heck if I know, maybe they would keep it secret. You never know.
To end this, and I think this conversation has thrown up enough material for us to start another four conversations in the future, so let's hope we can do that, John.
Absolutely.
Can you give me one concrete and definite example of some mystery here, maybe a missing person, maybe something like that, that you have become involved in and you have solved or helped to solve?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a company we worked for, and they built amusement parks. And they were building an amusement park in China, Suzhou, China. And they had to have a Chinese businessman help them because they didn't know the ins and outs of business there. And so he took off with a whole bunch of money. They couldn't find him. They won a court case, a judgment against him in the United States.
Are you telling me here that you used your influence to trace this person?
Yeah, we found this person. So they even brought in private investigators in the FBI, got involved in this case for whatever reason, and they couldn't find him. They couldn't find him, but we found him, and we found where his assets were, and we brought him to the negotiating table. So yeah, that was very successful. And, you know, it's the power of remote viewing. It takes time. It takes a lot of taskings for the remote viewers to work through, and it takes a lot of analysis, and it takes a couple months at least.
Mm-hmm. And when you say you brought him to the negotiating table, you mean that there was a deal done between this gentleman and the company?
Exactly.
Okay. And what of the theme park? Is it there now?
I don't think so.
Any other examples? Maybe a missing person in America or something like that?
You know, there was... When we work with on missing people... that goes into, we've worked a lot of missing people cases. And what happens with the cold cases is that they take a long time to figure out. And we don't, by that time, we're not privy to any investigations or inside information, but we have worked a lot. I just don't know the status. I'd have to check to see status of some of these people that we worked on, but no idea. We usually work them, give it to them, and then they go off and do whatever they do with it. And then later on, maybe some of the information that we gave them comes out on the side, on the media side.
Have there been cases that have had a reward connected with them, and have you been able to collect rewards?
No, we typically don't work cases where there's that monetary reward when it comes to missing people. Missing people is difficult for remote viewers because of the trauma around it. And so we do it only when we're asked by either a police department or a family member. Otherwise, we've found that it's not something we want to get involved in.
Mm. And if some institute, maybe they have, wanted to test your abilities, your team's abilities, and, I don't know, put an object somewhere on this planet or locate something that they knew existed but nobody else did, would you be up for accepting that challenge to prove whether or not you're actually able to do this?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a possibility. We did do that kind of stuff in the past to prove it. It jumped through a lot of hoops. You know, that's the thing with remote viewing, is that people want to have it proved to them when it's actually much more effective to learn how to do it yourself.
And then prove it to yourself. Because the reason I'm asking you this is that I know there are people preparing their emails to me right now, and maybe you'll get some too, saying that you're just making all of this up.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. And yeah, we do that. Right. But, you know, I mean, if we do that kind of stuff, we did it on TV, you know, for like CBS Sunday Morning, remote viewing, like the Lincoln assassination, stuff like that, you know, blind on camera. We did a lot of that stuff. And one thing that I learned, yeah, we will still do it occasionally, but one thing that I learned was that even when you do that, people are still not very convinced by it. But when you teach them how to do it, you know, teach a man to fish and he'll feed himself forever, you know? But yeah, we will. We will do that kind of stuff on occasion.
What are you working on now?
Right now, what I'm mostly interested in is are doing expeditions. So we look at areas that have a just an inordinate amount of high strangeness to them, from UFOs to cryptids to just paranormal events and energies, claims people make. And we look at the narrative behind it, why it's happening. We look at, we interview subjects, we interview people, and then we remote view where we can capture evidence ourselves. And then we go out on expeditions to find that evidence through the remote viewing data. So that's really, that's what I'm working on right now. And that's typically up in the Pacific Northwest. Big reason why I'm up here.
Okay. Does Bigfoot exist?
As far as remote viewings, I've never seen Bigfoot, but I've seen purported evidence and we have remote viewed. And I would say yes.
Apparently you smell them before you see them.
Apparently you do.
Which is an interesting point at which to park to park this conversation. If people want to read about you, and I hope we'll talk again, John, where do they go online?
They can go to righthemispheric.com, my website. I'm also on YouTube, Right Hemispheric. Got some videos there. I have a book called The Time Before the Secret Words. I'm all over the place.
You are, and I'm glad you've done this conversation with me. And Right Hemispheric, is that because the techniques that you use involve the right hemisphere of the brain, presumably?
Yep, that is it.
Okay, see, I worked that out. Look at that. Look how quick I am. John, let's talk again, okay?
I appreciate your time, and we surely will.
The amazing and mysterious world of remote viewing with John Vivanco. I'll put a link to him and his work on my website. We have more great guests to come as we cruise our way through 2019 here on The Unexplained. If you have a guest suggestion, please go to my website. And don't forget, if you want to send me an email, and it's lovely to hear from you. You know, it's kind of lonely when you sit here doing shows in isolation. And certainly at the beginning of all of this, years and years and years ago, I didn't get very many emails. People hadn't discovered the show. So you would feel isolated, and you'd think, is anybody hearing this? And over the years, of course, a lot of regular listeners have established themselves, and new people are coming on board all the time, which is nice. But when you get in touch, and I'd love to hear from you, please tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show. I'm sounding like a broken record now, aren't I? I keep saying that. Go to my website, theunexplained.tv, and you can do that there, or send me a donation. And like I said at the beginning of the show, if you have sent a donation recently, very many thanks to you from me for doing that. Okay, that's it then. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. I am in springtime London. And until next we meet here, please stay safe, please stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.